From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes a new movie called Challengers, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya plays Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who transforms her husband, Art, into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt her husband out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event, close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when Art finds himself standing across a net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Tensions run high as past and present collide. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26. Get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like, it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations, because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Today is no exception. I'll let Elise fill you in on her extraordinary guest. All right, over to Elise.
Tom Philpott is a veteran journalist, former farmer, and the current food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. He's also the author of a brand new book called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. It's a thoroughly researched tale of how American agriculture went wrong, as well as a smart, hopeful roadmap for avoiding the ultimate disaster. I loved hearing Tom's stories of farmers and communities who are paving the way, and I think you'll enjoy learning about how you can join the cause too.
That's another thing hanging over the food system in California is it isn't just the specter of drought that is coming for the Central Valley. It is also the specter of a massive biblical style flood.
Let's get to my conversation with Tom Philpott.
Congrats on your book. Your first book, hard to publish during a pandemic, but I think people are, if ever, a captive audience, particularly as we think about ways to rebuild all of our systems. So maybe the timing is perfect, in fact.
I've thought about that too. It's a book that it isn't about a frivolous topic that's going to seem frivolous very soon or already feels frivolous. So I do feel like as we move out of this crazy pandemic, if we are able to, then the message of this book is going to be really important.
Yeah. And one of the debates we do in my team, we have scientists scattered throughout the company, but two of them sit within the content org, and we do our sort of we meet twice a week collectively on Zoom just to chat. And really all we ever want to talk about is COVID. And one of the questions that I have every single time is, when will we know, or will we ever know, whether the U.S. is, and granted, I get that this is a complicated question, but whether the U.S. is being so specifically ravaged because we're being idiots about masks, or is it because we're so vulnerable and we have such a failing food system that has left us sick and ill and full of comorbidities? Or is it the perfect storm of all of those things? Like, I wonder if when we retroactively look back, how much of it we'll be able to peg on the fact that we are eating, as you say, I can't remember the exact calorie breakdown, but we're eating such a massive amount of sort of soybean and corn-derived products. It's like, what, 40% of our calories, including the animal products that they support?
Yeah, I think there is probably something there, because we knew going into this pandemic that we had really high levels of basically diet-related diseases, things like type 2 diabetes, heart conditions, And these are all the kind of conditions that you don't want to have going into something that attacks your body like COVID-19. I mean, I think there probably isn't very much question at all that our lack of good public health heading into this has made us a lot more vulnerable. And yeah, that's part of what sets us apart from other industrialized countries and just our such a dismal performance during this.
Yeah. And we can get into sort of the specific food system in the U.S. And the book obviously focuses on California and Iowa and the complicating factors in each area geographically and all of those other factors. But I think that the bigger question, and I think the bigger overlying thesis of the book seems to be, and it's something that we think about and talk about all the time, and I know that the people who read Goop are equally concerned, is that we're destroying our diversity in our own guts, in our environment, in the bird population, in the way that we farm, and we've become completely monocrop culture in a way that's reflected up and down spiritually, down to the nanobiome. And our food supply is essentially controlled by the three big players that you outline in the book. And that is terrifying, understandably, and with unknown health implications in terms of the load of pesticides that's being literally rained on us. So
yeah,
where do you want to start?
I think that is a really good place to start, because I think, you know, a publication organization like Goop is really concerned with diet. And I think it's pretty intuitive that one of the principles of a good diet is to have a lot of diversity, to eat a lot of different things that bring a lot of different nutrients and things like that. And I think that the argument that I'm making in my book is that just as we've done that with our diets, just as we've really narrowed down, and as a society, we have a very narrow diet, it's not surprising that we've done the same thing in agriculture, that our agriculture has gone from pretty good complexity, lots and lots of different things growing out in fields, to in these two crucial areas that I talk about in the book, this real narrowing of crop diversity, this real separation of corn and soybean and general grain production from animal production. The two have become completely separated. And I think that there is an analogy to be drawn. There is a soil biome, just as there is a human gut microbiome. And there's no doubt that when you do that, and when you dump on fertilizers and things like that, you're depleting that soil biome.
Yeah, beyond the biome, sort of the thing that's, and obviously this is so complex. And maybe, do you want to start with Iowa or do you want to start with California?
Maybe let's start with California.
Okay. So as you outline, obviously we're feeding the world, among others, but essentially almost all of our food is coming out of California, despite the fact that we have an ongoing, perpetual, non-abating water crisis.
So if you look at the produce aisle in a grocery store in the United States, whether you're actually in California or you're in the Midwest or down in Florida or up in New York, for most of the seasons of the year, including the growing season wherever you are, which is in most of the U.S., it's the sort of spring until the fall, even in that growing season, most of the vegetables and fruits in the supermarket, the conventional supermarket, are going to be from out of state. There's going to be some imports in there from places like Mexico and Chile, but the biggest provider by far is going to be California and just a few regions of California. We're talking about the Central Valley, the Salinas Valley, and the Imperial Valley. And they grow in those three places. You're talking about the great bulk of fruits and vegetables that Americans consume.
And can you sort of outline, I know you talk about in the 70s how there was this, I think you call it an aquatic utopia outline, where there was this idea that whatever, that there'd be enough water in the mountains to refill the aquifers, and that in times of drought, we could draw on those, but that we've completely overdrawn them. And now we're actually, was it 2014 legislature that's now going into effect? So can you sort of explain where the water crunch is coming from, and then also the idea of this potential of extreme flooding?
Sure. The region I focus on most in the book is the Central Valley. That's this valley that goes, you know, basically up the entire state from Southern California to the very northern border. And it's between the Sierra Nevada mountain range and the coastal mountain ranges. And it's a place that most people, when they visit this tourist mad California, they might see it between San Francisco and LA on a car trip, or maybe going out to the beautiful parks of the Sierra Nevada. But so this region is probably the most intensively planted region in the United States, especially outside of the Corn Belt, which we'll talk about later. And so it actually has incredible water resources. So the Sierra Nevada is this huge mountain range that every winter, let's say most winters, collects a rather large snowpack. So snow falls all winter and the snow melts. And it, you know, runs down the mountains in the spring. And before sort of white settlers showed up in the, you know, well, the first, the Spanish showed up, they didn't really do much to it. But when the sort of U.S. white settlers showed up is when things really changed. And before that, there were massive rivers running through it. There were huge expanses of it were wetlands, incredible biodiversity. Many Native American tribes lived there. This incredibly biodiverse region. And so what U.S. agriculture has done, basically starting around 1850, is it's completely diverted these rivers. It's dammed them. It's diverted the water into aqueducts. And the great bulk of that water now goes to farming. And that is why this region is so productive. It's also got really rich soil. So you can imagine these rivers bringing all the silt down off the mountains over years and years, building up the soil. And so this industry rises up in the 19th century, but exploding in the 20th century, and it's just ravenous for more and more water, more and more control of the water. And these interests get the U.S. government to build out this incredible infrastructure for trapping that water. This happens in the middle of the 20th century, and it was actually a great thing because before that, when the water supply was erratic because they didn't have the aqueducts and dams and stuff to control the water, farmers, if they couldn't get water from the mountains, they would just tap a well and go underground for it into the aquifers. And they were tapping so much water from these aquifers that were incredibly voluminous stores of water, just from millennia of water dripping down from the mountains. They were taking it so much of it that the land was sinking. And by sinking, I mean like a foot a year, sometimes even more than that. And that was causing all kinds of havoc. And so by building out this infrastructure, they basically put it into balance. And the aquatic utopia I talk about was this period when you would have lean years in the snowpack, and farmers would draw more from underground and they would deplete the aquifer a little bit. And then the snowpack would return and the water would come gushing down. Farmers would be okay. A little bit would trickle down and replenish the aquifer a little bit. But farmers weren't really taking too much out of the aquifer and you went into balance. And so that takes place, let's say, from the 70s until around the turn of the 21st century. What happens then is the industry gets so ravenous, it builds out so much, it's more and more of the supermarket shelf, and it's taking more and more water, and that utopia begins to unravel, and they start taking more from underground than they're able to replenish, and we go back to the bad old days. And so you see this depletion of the aquifers, and then the 2011 drought hits, and basically all hell breaks loose after that. And it really exposed just how much water they were taking.
Yeah, it was terrifying. I live in LA and I'm not a farmer, but it was clear that we were in deep doo-doo. I mean, it's not the right word, but it's, and obviously when you're in the midst of something like that and we're in weather chaos because of climate change anyway, it is really scary. And I think that's when people became aware of the fact that we have so many nut trees going that are so thirsty that we're not even farming in a way that matches the natural capacity of the land, we're completely overburdening. We're going for crops that we can't support.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And so now there was regulation that was passed in 2014 to prevent or try to stall out the overdrawing of the aquifers. And now that's setting up sort of another rethinker crisis. Or is that not gone into effect yet?
It hasn't quite gone into effect yet. It's going to start going into effect pretty soon. But so what happened was things got so bad. And basically this kind of, what's the opposite of utopia? Water hill takes over. And we're back to sinking again. It's called subsidence. And parts of the San Joaquin Valley, not that far north of Los Angeles, start to sink. Some cases, once again, a foot a year. And you can imagine the havoc that wreaks on roads and bridges. And then it also does something really bad to the aqueducts themselves. So these sort of canals that are carrying water to the farms, as the ground sinks under them, it sinks in an inconsistent pattern. And so it starts to snarl up. And you get this beautiful snowmelt that is the lifeblood of California, lifeblood of California farming, just spilling off and being wasted, just evaporating and not getting to farmers. And of course, when farmers lose that water, when good years come, they're just going to make up for it by going into the aquifer again. So you're in this really bad feedback cycle. And Governor Brown and the legislature in 2014 realized that the old law of California, the old water law, which was if you own the land, you could drop a straw into it and suck as much damn water out as you wanted, that wasn't going to work. It was leading to literally an arms race. So we're neighbors, Elise, you and I. And so I've got my 10,000 acres or whatever of almonds. And so I drop some really big wells and start sucking the water out. And of course, the aquifer doesn't stop at the property line. We share the aquifer. And now your well is going dry. And so you're like, damn it, I'm going to build an even bigger one. And so there's this well drilling frenzy. Neighbors are getting pissed off at each other. And so in 2014, they overturned basically the entire California history of basically laissez-faire water regulations on groundwater and said, okay, by 2040, these aquifers have to come into balance. In other words, you can't, over a certain amount of time, you can't draw more out than is being replenished. And so what that basically does is it's going to force the industry, and we'll see how it plays out and how these interests try to get around it, but it's going to force them to live off of the snowpack with the groundwater, the aquifer water, just being a supplement every once in a while instead of just having as much as they want of it. And so we're going to see over the next 20 years, quite probably, a drop in food production in the Central Valley for that reason.
Yeah, but it seems like we need to make that adjustment at some point. And we'll get into some of the other things that you think are potential solves and ways to fix this. And you also, throughout the book, I think, set up this idea that the farmers, and certainly not the farm workers, nobody's benefiting from this. It's a terrible business, more or less, except for the big, huge, I didn't even realize that there's big tractor, but there's even big tractor in farming.
I should just say, in that statement is very true of the Corn Belt, the sort of Iowa end of things. It's a little different in California because California farmers have managed. So if you're an Iowa farmer, you're growing corn and soybeans, everyone's growing the same thing. They're growing it in Brazil, they're growing it in other places. And so you've got really low prices and you're a price taker. California farmers have one advantage, and that is that almonds and pistachios, unlike corn and soybeans, don't have a whole lot of places they can grow. They've got to be in Mediterranean climates. And as a result, they have a lot more pricing power, let's say, than their Iowa peers. And so they are able to make fortunes off of pistachios and almonds in a way that no one's going to do on corn and soybeans. There's this rising demand, and we have an almond craze here for various reasons. People are eating more protein, and it is actually a very healthy food. But in China, where there was no snacking culture to speak of until very recently, The industry has really advertised almonds there and created an almond boom in China that basically guarantees rising demand that gives them some pricing power in the market. It doesn't always hold up. Sometimes there's a glut. We can talk about reasons why, like that the trade war with China did not help on that. But they're in a lot better position than their peers in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. No, that totally makes sense. But the farm workers are not. The farm workers are, was it Alpo? I'm not sure how to say that, the town that you where you visit and explore. Yeah, exactly what's happening there in terms of how the workforce is living, how toxic their water supply is, and how they're surrounded by these trees that are consuming all the clean water in the land.
Yes. So that is the town of Alpa in Tulare County. And I went there during the drought, I think in 2015, literally surrounded on all sides by pistachio groves. They can't even grow almonds there because the soil is so salty from so many years of irrigation that almonds aren't very salt tolerant. Pistachios are a little bit more salt tolerant. And so I was in the town of Alpa, where the people in the town are literally drinking water that is laced with arsenic at above the EPA limit. That's really because the aquifer has gotten so depleted. They're so close to the bottom of the aquifer that these naturally occurring elements like that are at very high concentrations. And so this farm worker community, where people make maybe $20,000 a year per capita, are spending huge amounts of money compared to their salaries to buy bottled water. And in 2015, because of the drought, there were ordinances against them watering their lawns, watering their fruit trees that helped them feed their families. And it was quite impressive to step out, go a mile out of town, and be in the middle of a pistachio grove that they were putting in, with these little pistachio starts, these little saplings going in as far as the eye can see in all directions, and just wells everywhere, unregulated, being dug, in some cases already pumping water out of the ground without any regulation. So if you're a farm worker, you can't water your lawn, you have to let your fruit tree die. But if you're a wealthy pistachio grower, it's a free-for-all.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and the 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
And then the other thing that I thought was just staggering in terms of, and again, I get that it's sort of one of those, we're not good as a country at solving upstream problems, and it's like just letting the calamity hit us, and maybe hopefully we'll learn. But I had no idea that California also has a history of massive flooding. And I know we'll get to Iowa in a second, where that's, I think you write that there, between 2003 and 2017, central Iowa has endured no fewer than 400-year storms. But California is long overdue for a massive flood. And I can only imagine the fact that the floor is sinking in the Central Valley, that it would be even more devastating than it was when it happened. Was it in the 19th century?
It was.
Yeah.
1851, 1852, that winter. California has not been a state very long at this point. The gold rush is still going, starting to peter out a little bit. And the rain comes, as a Californian, basically your rain comes in the winter. Rain and snow come in the winter, and it's pretty dry all summer. So the rain comes at a certain point in December and just doesn't stop for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it also, there's already some snow up in the mountains. It hits the snow and melts it, and it just keeps on raining and raining. And so what happened was basically the entire Central Valley. So you're talking about what is it take about an hour to get to the Central Valley from LA driving north. It's pretty far down into Southern California, all the way up to the Oregon border or close to the Oregon border. you get this, the entire Central Valley is under 10 feet of water. Probably one of the worst natural disasters in the whole history of the United States. And the interesting thing about it is it's been pretty much erased from the popular memory. I've talked to lifelong Californians who are really into the state's history that have never heard of it. But archaeologists and paleoclimatologists have looked into the fossil record. They've looked at tree rings and residues around streams that have been there forever. And what they found is that a storm of this caliber, or even much bigger, happens about every 100 to 200 years. And the last one happened around 150 years ago. And so, or 160 years ago, I should say. And so I'm doing my math wrong. It's 170 years. It was 1850, and that gets us all the way to 2000. And now we've got 20 more years. So it's 170 years. And the idea is that we're probably due for one of these coming up soon. And then when you look at climate change research, what the climate change scholars find is that the California snowpack, as we go forward, is going to be dwindling because of climate change. We're going to see fewer and fewer storms and more drought years like we saw from 2011 to 2016. But at the same time, we're going to see more powerful storms. And there's a guy at UCLA named Dr. Swain who says that from his research that he's done, we're looking at one of these things happening in the next 20 years. And so consider the Central Valley at that time. It was pretty sparsely populated. We had already killed many or driven away many of the Native American tribes. The Spanish didn't really settle it very much. It was used for grazing was the main thing that happened in it. All the original lakes and wetlands were all still there, meaning that not lakes, but also rivers and lakes and wetlands were all still there. And there just weren't that many people there. Think about it now. Fresno, Bakersfield, Sacramento, these are very fast growing cities, some of the fastest growing cities in California. A lot of people are refugees from LA and San Francisco areas. Also, you've got a huge farm worker community that wasn't there before. And these people are in incredible danger from it. And then think about the food system. This is the same exact place where all of this food that we eat comes from. And you're talking about at least one growing season essentially wiped out. And then think of all the pesticides and chemicals that weren't there before from all this farming. Think about all the incredible amounts of cow production, of cattle for beef, of cows for dairy, and all their manure. Think about the massive slurry of manure and pesticides and oil. Have you ever been to Bakersfield? I figured out that Kern County has about twice the oil production of Louisiana.
Wow.
Sitting there in the San Joaquin Valley. And that's another thing that hanging over the food system in California is it isn't just the specter of drought that is coming for the Central Valley. It is also the specter of a massive biblical style flood.
Yeah. With all of that stuff theoretically being moved all over the place and redeposited.
Exactly.
Yeah. With untold health impacts.
Yeah.
So let's shift, because I know that what's happening in Iowa is also, obviously, there's major climate change participation in that, in the sense that the water, the rain that's coming, and clearly they have droughts as well, but it's not so much the water that is in crisis as it is the soil and the impact of those storms on the soil as it just erodes it even more. So can you give us sort of a baseline understanding of what's happening in the Corn Belt?
Yeah. So what I go into in the book is how when you devote millions, tens of millions of acres of farmland in a place like Iowa, in a place like the Midwest that has this incredible cache of topsoil. The topsoil in the Midwest is one of the greatest stores of topsoil on earth. It developed over millennia it was a prairie with lots of wetlands as well that developed interactions between bison and people and other animals, basically Native Americans playing a huge role, very high populations of Native Americans. And basically these interactions created a situation where you had this incredibly rich topsoil with incredible prairie grasses and wetlands driving this population of birds apparently beyond imagination when you read accounts of white settlers who went and described it. And so you've gone from that to make a long story short, just two crops, corn and soybeans. And they're both planted in the spring and harvested in the fall. And in between those two times, so let's say October, November to the next, when you really get establishment of a crop, well into May, the granite's completely bare. And if anyone spent a winter or early, you know, spring in the Midwest knows, you get lots and lots of storms. And when you get storms hitting bare land, soil goes on the move. And so I document in the book that basically because of this factor, this, you know, leaving the ground bare, the Midwest is losing topsoil at something like the rate of 16 times as fast as it's naturally produced. And so just as California is basically taking this great water situation that the Central Valley has and completely overused it and abused it, the same thing is happening in California with the soil resource. And when soil goes on the move, it doesn't just, it's not just soil, it's all the damn chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, herbicides that farmers have. You have to apply these things if you're going to do monocropping, if you're going to do just huge stands of corn and soybeans, and all of that gets washed into the water. And just like people in the Central Valley basically don't have access to clean water, there's also a water pollution crisis like crazy in the Midwest.
And that goes all the way, like that's the Gulf of Mexico, like this water full of these chemicals is moving throughout, it's moving to the ocean, and we're getting those algal blooms, those, just the toxicity is spreading everywhere.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the fertilizer doesn't just fertilize crops. When it goes on the move, it fertilizes algae. And so you get these really gross algae blooms that among the things they do is they suck all the oxygen out of water. So you get dead zones in the Gulf. And in freshwater places like Lake Erie, they feed a different kind of algae that produces human toxins. And sometimes in places like Toledo and Columbus and places like that, you get these warnings, don't drink the water, it's toxic. And don't even wash your kids in it, don't take a shower in it, really bad stuff.
Yeah. And this pressure to create, and it seems like, from what I understand from your book, that between the corn and the soybeans, that we're massively overproducing them to the, it is, we're exporting most of it, but not to countries where we have, where we're still seeing starvation and lack of food security. It's going to primarily developed nations. So the whole, like, we need GMOs, we need this massive production in order to feed the world is not carrying through. And farmers are being destroyed in the process.
That's exactly right. I mean, the overproduction is just eye-popping and ridiculous and almost comical. I saw literal mountains of corn in July when there's a huge crop of corn in all around it. And I love that you made that point about, you talk to these guys, these sort of agrochemical executives or USDA people, and they'll say, oh, we're feeding the world. And if you look at exports numbers, it isn't going to, like, basically poor countries, low-income countries can't afford this stuff. What it's basically doing is it's going into the meat industries of countries with large middle classes. So it's not feeding poor people in China, it's feeding middle-class people in China because they are eating more and more meat. Or it's going to Canada or places in Europe or Mexico, but once again, it's not poor Mexicans eating the fruits of this stuff. It's the wealthier people who can afford to eat a sort of US style, essentially half pound of meat a day kind of diet. So it's not doing very much at all to end hunger or starvation.
Right. Which is, I think, the way that people talk about GMOs as being, and I'm not slamming all GMOs, but in the context of this, the big ag GMOs that are threaded with these, with their own proprietary insecticides and fungicides, like they're trying to ride this wave of being good for people on the planet, which is clearly not happening. I love to just the basic math. I think it was Jonathan Foley where he was talking about that the average Iowa, I'm reading to you from your book, if you don't mind, the average Iowa cornfield has the potential to deliver more than 15 million calories per acre each year, which is enough to sustain 14 people per acre with a 3,000 calorie per day diet if we ate that corn ourselves. But with the current allocation of corn to ethanol and animal production, we end up with an estimated 3 million calories of food per acre, enough to sustain only 3 people per acre. This is lower than the average delivery of food calories from farms in Bangladesh, Egypt, and Vietnam.
Yeah, it's stunning. So instead of just directly eating what's grown, we basically run it through the body of an animal and eat that animal, and incredible amounts of calories are wasted in the process. And we can talk about the just massive amount of waste, including literal manure and all the pollution that comes from that is also part of it.
Let's talk about, the question you ask, where does all the hog shit go? So theoretically, and again, please correct me, but historically, the land is best served when it is, and manure is obviously a tremendous fertilizer as long as it's not overloading the ground, and that there are these virtuous cycles of crop diversity that then feeds the earth along with animal waste, et cetera, and you get into this like really rich soil territory. But what's happening in places like Iowa, which is also producing they have a ton of hog herds, right? Tons of chickens, tons of cows, is that they're not distributed across farms the way that they used to be, where that manure would go back into the soil in a sensible way, in a reasonable way. They're all on farms. So you have, this was wild. All told, Iowa's hog herd delivers as much waste as 83.7 million humans. So in fecal terms, there are 28 hogs for every human Iowa resident. And then once you get into including cows, etc., it is 55 fecal equivalents to every person in Iowa in terms of density.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That is insane. And so where does that waste go?
So what they do with it is all those animals are, even in Iowa, they're concentrated in a few parts of the state. And so basically what they do is they overapply it to the ground. They apply too much of it. They apply more then can be taken up by the land. And so it goes on the move. It goes on the move all year round, but it goes on the move in a really bad way during these cataclysmic winter and spring storms along with soil. But it basically just leaches out, and it's leaching out nitrogen and phosphorus, big parts of manure. So it makes them valuable fertilizer. And that causes the algae blooms you were just talking about. It's also full of antibiotic resistant bacteria that can cause disease because they tend to use a lot of antibiotics in these facilities. I should also say that nitrogen is a terrible thing to have in your water. If you have it at levels that are common throughout the Midwest, it basically causes cancer and other maladies. It can cause blue baby syndrome. If the baby gets too much of it, basically it starves you of oxygen. Adults can handle a little bit of that, but a baby will literally turn blue. So basically what happens is it just goes into creeks and streams and rivers and ultimately down to the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm. And meanwhile, so 60% of the state's farms since the dawn of the industrial culture in the 40s have evaporated, right? All these farmers are losing their farms because of the economic pressure of overproducing these crops where the price is plummeting, and they're at the mercy of big ag, massive industries that own 60% of the global pesticide trade and 60% of the global seed market. Stunning. But there's some bright spots, right? So there are some farmers that you profile that are taking things back into their own hands, rehabilitating their soil, and showing what's possible with greater yields, that's more drought resistant, that's certainly better for the planet. So can you take us through the like Brandt farmers like that who are going regenerative, not necessarily purely organic, but just completely focused on soil health, soil retention, and I guess economic viability ultimately.
Yeah, the economics are tough, and I'll explain why. But basically, what someone like David Brandt, who's a farmer in central Iowa, what he's doing is, you know, basically at the start of the conversation, I was just talking about how we've gone from complex systems to really simple systems where, you know, you do corn and soybeans, that's all you grow. And then instead of having hogs or cows in the pasture rotating through after the crops are harvested, that are, you know, literally in a box. They're literally in a, the hogs are in a giant facility. The cows are in a feedlot, never seeing after their calves, never seeing grass again. What Brand is doing is he's simply adding complexity to the system. He never lets his ground go bare. And so what he does is when he's harvested his cash crops in the fall, he plants this incredibly biodiverse mix of cover crops. He'll do 12 or 13 species. He'll do grasses like rye that suck up a lot of carbon and put a lot of carbon in the soil. He'll do legumes like vetch that grab nitrogen from the air and put it in the soil so he doesn't, basically doesn't have to fertilize. He'll do radishes that will plunge a root deep into the soil and create air pockets, and he'll leave the radish in, and as it rots, it's adding nutrients to the soil. So he's created this kind of ballet of biodiversity in his field in the off season. And what it's done is it's basically eliminated the need for him to use herbicides, because he just literally rolls something over like a crimper attached to his tractor, and that kills the cover crop in the spring. And then he drills his seeds straight into it. Herbicides when he has to, which is very rarely. Basically what he's doing is, and so just imagine those cover, you got this mat of cover crops. It's blocking weeds from getting a foothold. So it basically eliminates weeds. And as it rots, it's just adding organic matter to the soil. It's building it up. It's making it better at retaining water. It's making it better at staying in place. When there's a giant storm, you go to his neighbor's bare field and you'll see these gashes in the soil where soil has just washed away, and his is just sitting there. It's under this, the roots of the cover crops, and the stuff above ground is buffering the rain from hitting it really hard, and the roots are holding it in. And so he's just got this incredible system that builds up lots of soil, and he does corn, soybeans, and wheat. Almost no one else does a third crop, and that has all kinds of benefits too. But the problem is that he is in the same commodity market as his neighbors are. So when corn goes down to $2.50 a bushel, imagine that. A bushel of corn is 66 pounds, and it can get as low as $2 for 66 pounds of corn. He's basically getting the same price. He doesn't want to go organic for his, you know, various own reasons. And some of his neighbors are learning from him. But I think that it's really important to note that these people aren't crazy. They're not doing this thing to their soil because they're stupid. It's because there are policies in place that these giant companies that we're talking about that control the tractor market and the seed market and the pesticide market and buy all the grain and own all the slaughterhouses that process the animals, these companies keep this system in place where farmers get insurance, they get crop, you know, subsidized crop insurance, they get subsidies, and so there's very little incentive for them to try something new. They see him over there, they're chilling out after their harvest is in, counting what little money they made on their crop, and David Brand is going crazy getting his cover crops in. And they're like, why would I want to do that when I got my government payments coming? A rational decision, but it's what keeps this system in place.
And the big three, and obviously now Monsanto is owned by Bayer, which is a German company, and then Syngenta is Chinese, and then Corteva is Dow and DuPont in combination, right? Rebranded. Yes. I love how everyone just keeps rebranding in order to try to escape their past.
Exactly.
But Meanwhile, I thought this was so chilling, the advent of precision agriculture and big data in farming, and that was it one of the Monsanto executives, I guess before it became Bayer, who said that they want to be the Amazon of farmers, essentially. They want to control everything.
Yeah, it's a monopolistic vision that he was not at all shy about talking about in public.
Yeah, stunning. And so what you put forth, and I know you, like me, are potentially hopeful about a concept like a Green New Deal, depending on, I guess, what happens in November. But this idea to really reimagine all sectors and create new systems around equity and also the environment and environmental responsibility and supporting family farming, sustainable farming, soil health, all of those things. And it seems like what you also are proposing is that consumers want access to good, high quality food locally. The farmers markets have grown dramatically, things like CSAs, and that if we could readjust the way that we could reallocate farmland to vegetables and fruits, so it's not just in California and that other parts of the country would be used for farming, we might get to a more sustainable place quite quickly.
Yeah, that's basically right. I mean, getting from where we are to that new policy regime is where the real trick is going to lie. But I do get some strange hope from this COVID-19 just meltdown that we're in. What is the word? It so much exposed the cracks in so many of our systems, in our healthcare system, in our disaster readiness system. If we treat the disaster of a flood in California with the same sort of incompetence that we're reacting to the COVID disaster, it's pretty chilling. So I think it's exposing a lot of rot in our policy structures. And so I think that if we get a progressive turn in the November election and we get some policymakers who want to respond to the COVID crisis, let's say, by improving public health, by improving healthcare, I think a lot of sectors of society that are dysfunctional are also going to be up for change. And we had two politicians running in the Democratic side in 2020 that didn't make it, but Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were both essentially pushing agriculture policies that are the most radical thing we've seen, with the exception of Jesse Jackson, who also had, in the 80s, he had some very progressive agriculture ideas. And I feel like there is space open on a policy level in that regard. And also this COVID disaster, I think, is opening space for rethinking a lot of systems. And I think agriculture, I get every once in a while, I'm a cynical journalist, but a little bit of hope seeps in and I'm just like, what's that? But I do think that it's real.
Yeah. And it seems like it's going to be essential. We didn't really talk about this, but the carbon that we're releasing by tilling the land the way that we do in Iowa, by the fact that it's bare, by the fact that it's not retaining anything, is also significant. I think one of the scientists that you speak to suggests that if all farmers in the Corn Belt adopted Brandt-style agriculture, which is to plant cover crops and enrich the soil and really focus on that as one of the primary factors in the way that they think about their land, that it would suck down 20 times more carbon than they currently do, which is equivalent to nearly 10% of the U.S. car fleet off the road, which is significant.
Yeah. And I think that you could even get those numbers up higher if you did other. Brandt's got a great system, but that was your goal. So Brandt is not going out there saying, I want to suck carbon up, because no one's paying him to. Basically, his thing is, I want to keep my soil healthy and grow my crops. But if someone said, hey, we're going to pay you based on how much carbon, instead of giving you a subsidy like we do now just for producing a bunch of corn and soybeans, we're going to make it so that your subsidy level goes up and down with the amount of carbon you have in your soil, I think we'll see lots of innovations. I've been even hearing about agroforestry in the Midwest, where you could actually plant basically nut trees, not on a California insane scale, but you could work nut trees into farms that would produce a lot of food and produce a lot of value for the farmer, but would also sequester even more carbon. And so your cropland would be in a kind of Brandt style system. And then you have other things going on that suck even more carbon. And actually bringing the Midwest is a really good place. The Corn Belt is a really good place to let cows graze on land if managed properly, I should emphasize. There is even more carbon sequestration potential if you incorporate cattle into the land in a way that hasn't been done in a couple of generations.
So it seems like if we can get no one, I would, who knows? I cannot certainly speak for everyone, but it seems like most people want access to good, clean food. They don't, nobody wants this sort of corn soybean duopoly, right? Like, even I think you say over 4,000 school districts had farm to school programs trying to get fresher food to kids, typically who are low income and don't have access to good, clean food. So it feels like the consumer appetite is there to the point of feeling like that consumers are exceptionally stressed and frustrated about what's happening. Do you think that's all that it will take? Is a new administration to prioritize this? Like, it feels like sentiment is there.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I think that public desire for something different is there. I think that you can't pull the food system out of society. And as you well know, our society has got a lot of economic inequality. It's got a lot of really high levels of poverty and low-income people. That COVID is, the COVID crisis is exacerbating in dramatic fashion. Not everyone can afford the really nice food that you can get at a farmer's market, but I think that also people would like to be able to afford it. So I think that creating a more equal economy is also a big part of it. And I do have a hobby horse that I like to ride about how important the National School Lunch Program is. Because like right now, even with the Michelle Obama reforms in public school lunches that were basically nullified by the Trump administration, the Trump administration at least gave districts the permission to backslide. And a lot of them took it. Basically, her reform was a little bit less sugar, a little bit less sort of hydrogenated fat, a little bit more access to fruit and vegetables. But it didn't really change the budget that the schools have. And if you think about it, our schools, when you go to school, you're getting society's idea of how things should be. You want your teacher to be polite and courteous because we want to have a polite and courteous society. So you model that. The lunchroom models this industrial crap. It teaches, hey, this is an acceptable way to eat. And if we want to bring a public value of that other countries have, places like France and Japan, of eating is something beautiful and nice and something we pay attention to, and we fuss over our ingredients, we need to make the cafeterias do that. And so that mm-hmm. would be a lot more budget for cafeterias. It would mean longer lunch hours. I've been just reading about how lunch hours are down to 21 minutes or even less. So it's like this sort of cattle call, get through there and wolf down your industrial lunch as fast as possible. All that needs to change. And I think that's part of the change that we need to see.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Tom Philpott. I hope you're feeling as inspired as I am. And if you haven't already, pick up a copy of Tom's book, Perilous Bounty. It's out now. You can also read more about his work at tomphilpott.net. That's it for today's episode. If you have a chance, please rate and review. Hit subscribe to keep up with new episodes and pass it along to a friend. Thanks again for joining. I hope you'll come back for more. And in the meantime, you can check out goop.com/thepodcast.